There's one debate which is like, more often than you have, put your prices up because of inflation. Put your prices up because prices go up. But then the other thing is actually also parallel to that. How can you offer more stuff to people who want to pay more and charge them more? So I think the basic price will increase more regularly, but it's more about finding the what's the extra tier that will cost like £5 more that you feel is worth paying for. So there's two things going at the same time, I think.
And welcome to another Music On Eye Focus with me, Music On Eye's editor, Joe Sparrow. And in this episode, we're joined by, goodness me, it's none other than Stuart Dredge, Music On Eye's head of insight. And Stu will, with me, in this episode, try to answer some of the trickiest and complex questions that will need to be answered in the DSP space in 2024. More of that in 1 minute. Now, if you're not familiar with Music On Eye Focus, each episode analyzes one meaningful music business story at a time, and that means this podcast is also going to be fairly quick. It should take about the same amount of time as Joel Strasser could insert, hypothetically of course, 1,800 pencils into his beard. Joel inserted 59 pencils into his beard in 1 minute in 2021, and it must be noted that Joel has previously achieved 10 records for putting things in his beard. And he said, the pokes could get painful sometimes. Now, how we get from painful pokes to Stuart Dredge, I will leave up to you. But Stu did join me to talk through a bunch of the biggest questions and most important things that we can talk about in the music streaming space this year. And those questions include, who are the winners and losers from the artist-centric payment system transition, and will creators and labels be satisfied with what's happening? We also talk about how often and by how much music streaming platforms should raise their subscription prices, and are we now in an era of regular increases of how much it costs to subscribe to a streaming platform after 15 years of the price being a firm $9.99 a month. Also, we talk about what the industry's needs are around marketing from music streaming platforms, and whether a bold platform might finally go all in on fan communities within a streaming platform. So if you really need to get up to speed very quickly with all the issues that music streaming is facing in 2024, you are in the right place. So let's get over and speak to Stu right now. Well, I'm very happy to welcome back Music On Eye's head of insight, Stuart Dredge, to the podcast. Hello, Stu.
Hello. Hello. How are you? It's been a while.
Been a while. It's been a long overdue return to the podcast for you. Now, we're doing this podcast, which is sort of aligned with the March Music On Eye quarterly report, which is an overview of music streaming and the DSPs, which you have written and is very good. And so people who are listening to this, if you are a Music On Eye subscriber, you can go to musiconeye.com and find that full quarterly report and read into it. If you are not a Music On Eye subscriber, you can go and subscribe and read it. It works like that. Now, what we've got here are three big questions which sort of build on some of the observations and analysis you've done in the report, and we're going to dig a bit deeper into that. So one of the key points that you went over in the quarterly report is the change in payment systems out to artists. This is part of a bigger analysis around the economics of music streaming and what the platforms have been doing over the last year. But let's talk about artist-centric payment systems. What's been going on?
Yeah, well, I suppose the last few years, we've been writing a lot about the debates about the music streaming economy, haven't we? And a lot of that was like, how should we... The whole thing was the model is broken. That was the thing. Like the broken record in UK was like, it's a broken record. There was a campaign called Fix Streaming. And that was all coming from kind of artist rights campaigners who were saying, this doesn't work for artists. They're not earning enough. And then suddenly, like it was, I think it was in January last year, that Sir Lucian Grange, Universal Music's boss.
Thank you. Respect to you, please.
I think titles are important, you know.
I just operate a blanket system of ignoring all of them and treat everyone equally.
No, Sir Lucian Grange, but he wrote his memo to staff last year, and he said basically the streaming model is broken.
Right.
So the most powerful label in the business was saying, we want changes too. And then he was saying, we want an artist-centric model. And then over the course of last year, we kind of understood what that meant. And it was kind of about, it was about cracking down on fraud. It was about separating out music from non-music noise content. So white noise, wave sounds, swans flapping, that kind of thing. Mm. Is swans flapping a thing?
I think I go to sleep listening to geese honking. That's how I drift off at night.
Is it a 14-hour geese honking playlist?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
But then the other thing was, it's about shifting the royalties a bit from the least popular tracks towards the kind of what you'd think of as professional emerge artists. So artists who are trying to make a living. And that's been like, and the whole thing was about this, was that it's going to be different for each streaming service. I have their own methodology of doing that. But the core concept seems to be, we're going to shift the royalties a bit towards professional artists and away from the least popular stuff, the noise stuff, and the fraudsters.
Right. So let me put my cynical hat on for a second here and say that we've seen a shift from a campaign around remuneration for artists going from grassroots artists and artists feeling they're being underpaid to the most powerful man in the music business, in some people's opinion, Sir Lucian Grange, supporting this. And a cynic might say, well, the reason that he and Universal Music are being champions of artists being paid all of a sudden is because they're scared about artificial intelligence scraping away at their bottom line. That has forced the issue through, hasn't it? What the DSPs are doing is saying, well, if you don't really get very many streams at the bottom, we're going to not pay you until you reach a certain level. Then we're going to take that money that was being paid out and was just sitting there unclaimed, and we're going to redistribute it to artists and other things. So do those redistributions of money make a substantial difference to the artists who are really asking for it?
Well, so Spotify said the most about this. So they were like, they announced its kind of plans, and it said, right, we reckon we can reroute $1 billion towards professional emerging artists over the next 5 years. So that is through cracking down on fraud, that is through paying less to white to noise content, and that is through the rerouting. But it also said that, I think, so tracks with less than 1,000 annual plays account for 0.5% of its streams. And so around, which is like very little, but that's around $40 million a year of royalties. So it's kind of these two things here. So what I was saying, our overall changes will push $1 billion towards artists in the next 5 years. But in terms of the getting rid of the demonetizing the least popular tracks, that's $40 million a year.
Which is not a lot, really, is it? I mean, if you average that out between artists on Spotify who are eligible to earn that money, it's a couple of hundred extra dollars or euros or something, isn't it? Which of course is welcome, you know, but it's not really pushing the needle very far.
That's it. And even like at Musicolor Connect, our conference in January, Deezer's CEO talked about it, and he was kind of saying, yeah, it's only a small change. I think it's like 1-2% of the revenues. Or like everyone, it seems to be stressing, this is fixing streaming, while also saying this is not really a big, you know, it's not completely scaring the horses.
So is this just lip service then?
I feel like it's a step. Like, I feel like the one thing that everyone complained about was that streaming's model stayed the same from 2008 when Spotify launched until 2023. And what they don't want is that to happen now, like make a big change now and then the next 15 years runs the same. I think what people have been talking about is saying this is something that has to evolve. This is our first step. There were complaints about it from some of the independent sector. And I know Universal and Deezer both said at Musicolor Connect that we want to take feedback and that will help the evolution. So I feel like this is lip service is maybe that sounds like it's doing not really doing something and saying you are. I feel like it's more almost a statement of like, this is the direction of travel we want to go in, but there is going to be more to come. And that's one of the reasons there's been, I think, some concerns about it, because when you sort of, for example, one of the things here is on Spotify, if you have less than 1,000 annual streams, you don't get royalties. People are going, well, if this is the first step, do they put it up to 5,000 streams sometime? Do they put it up to 10,000? Like, where will it end? So I think that's one of the things where people are talking about this to reassure people, saying, look, it's just the first step. But that sometimes can make people go, well, what's the second step? And are we going to lose out?
Yeah, thin end of the wedge. I think everybody's probably happy that the 2007 system of $10 goes in, money gets split, pro rata comes out for everything at the other end needs a change. And you're right that is the thin end of the wedge. Where do we go from here? But also, is this, let's say this above 1,000 plays figure, is this more about fraud? Because we've talked about fraud a lot, and to summarize, you know, by various estimations, between 2-10% of all streams on streaming platforms are associated with fraudulent activity, which is a huge chunk. And you can imagine labels and streaming platforms, or perhaps more labels who own the rights to human created content, might look at this existing system and say, well, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that someone could use AI to generate millions of tracks, flood platforms with them, and just scrape pennies from 10 plays per track here, there, and everywhere, and sort of drain the pool from the bottom. And so this forces, if you like, a level of engagement above 1,000 streams, which suggests that it's real engagement. So while, you know, again, with my cynical hat on, is this sort of saying, hey, we're doing this for the artists, but actually it's protecting the bottom line of the people who hold the bulk of the catalogues?
I mean, I suppose what they would say is those two things are aligned, like what they're doing for themselves is work. Because I think it's true. Like you talked about fraud a lot more than I have, I think. Like, that's how fraud works in it. It's not about uploading one track and getting 10 million streams on it. It's about uploading a million tracks and getting a few streams on each and trying not to be detected.
Yeah.
So I think it very much is about fraud. Like that's kind of a good thing. But yeah, I think it's...
So when they call them artist-centric payment systems, which, I mean, clearly, like, you can argue in a logical language sense, yes, of course, this is ensuring that artists get paid, not fraudsters and not bots, right? That's fine. But if we take this conversation back to the originators of this, who are the grassroots artists saying, even as part of a portfolio mix of incomes, I can't make enough money to survive from streaming. Is this answering any of their concerns?
Do you know, I think there's almost a philosophical thing happening here, which is that...
Wait a minute, actually, Stu, we don't do philosophy on this podcast.
Yes, we do. I'm going back to the Plato, what Plato once said, Spotify stream model. No. I feel like... So Spotify actually made this quite clear in their Loud and Clear stuff recently, as you know, and loudly, clearly. They said 10 million people have uploaded to Spotify, but they reckon there's 225,000 artists trying to make a living, professional and emerging artists, so not inactive. And so that's interesting, because I think we're getting to that point now where we're saying, where the industry is saying, okay, anyone can upload, but what we want to do is focus on those 225,000 artists who are trying to make a living. So in a way, I think that's what it's that thing of, like, this idea that everyone can earn money, however small, from their streams. That's what's being kind of almost changed now. It's like, we're going to focus on the pros or the people who are trying to be pros. So in a way, and like you were saying, it's kind of small when you think with $40 million a year, that's not much between an artist, but it's almost like making that statement of, these are the people we want to be remunerating better. And this is the start. So Spotify used a metaphor of footballers, like millions of people play football, only a few hundred thousand are professionals. At Musical.ly Connect, Universal's Michael Nash talked about YouTube and how many people on YouTube or other platforms like that can upload videos, but you don't start earning until you reach a certain threshold and you get partner status and can then get a share of ads. Like, so they seem to be sort of saying, we need to think differently about music and think about, there are thresholds over which you will earn streaming royalties, which, you know, I'm still trying to pass that in my head about what I think about that. Because you could, when you make your first song, you might not get 1,000 streams, but that doesn't mean you're a hobbyist. It means you're at the start.
And yeah, maybe there's something there, isn't there? Because, you know, when I work with emerging artists, the conversation I always have with them is, you know, at this beginning phase of your career, which may last 2 or 3 years on average, maybe more, numbers are not important. Earning money from your music would be a great thing to happen, but actually growth and building a fan base and building that community and blah, blah, blah is what will sustain you in the future. So if that's what it's really about at that stage in your career, do the platforms do enough for that? To use the footballing analogy again, you know, there's no point being a football club that only ever buys extremely expensive professional players at the top of the game. You have to nurture new talent and bring them through. There's a cost attached, but it's nowhere near the same amount as buying, you know, Jude Bellingham, for instance.
Yeah, no, it's true. Although Chelsea are kind of think of throwing loads of money at young players.
We're going to pivot now to football banter, everybody. That's where this podcast is going.
But yeah, I think, I mean, that was another thing. I don't mean to keep making Musical.ly Connect, but Deezer's CEO, he said exactly that. He's like, you're earning 3 cents if you're doing, you know, that low streams. What you want is to be discovered. And what we need to do is to give you better tools to be discovered and build that fan base. So I think it's true. I think that maybe this is a thing, and it's not really been talked about so much, but maybe if you are going to start demonetizing or deboosting, in Deezer's case, people at the very lowest end, there maybe is a responsibility on you to keep working on tools for those people to build their audiences. So yeah, what have you built that will help someone go from 500 streams to 2,000 streams?
And that's definitely something we talked last year. One of the big stories in 2023, as we analyzed 2022, was that the platforms were trying to differentiate from each other and get away from the old problem of they all look the same, did the same thing, and all the records were in the same place. And you know, a little, if you can imagine a future where, you know, one platform, one DSP is much better for artist discovery and connecting listeners with brand new artists that they then go on to really, really like than others, and builds a community. Emerging artists are going to prioritize that one and then do the marketing for that platform for them and say, hey, go and listen to me over here because it's better. You know, and that is a powerful tool potentially, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, something I really want to do, and I think this is something Musical.ly is focused on in our training work, in our kind of editorial, is I want to help artists. I want to encourage artists and say, right, if you're starting out, here are the 10 things you can do to try and get yourself above that threshold to show that you are, you know, to show the companies that you were worth earning money. And I feel like there's a lot of stuff to be done there. And I think it's a streaming service, but also people like us, you know, saying, here are these tips, that here's how you build an audience. Like that idea of how you cut through that enormous noise on streaming, how you, you know, it's going to be a really important period. So I think you're right. I think it's not enough as a streaming service to just say, we're going to stop paying some of you. I think just to kind of continue that work. And Spotify has always been talking about what it's doing in Spotify for Artists. And some of those tools are paid, but a lot of them are free. Like playlist submission tool is free. I think we're going to see that kind of stuff happening, hopefully, across the board, so that, not to justify changing the model, but I think just to kind of say, right, we understand that some of you are starting from zero streams, but that doesn't mean you're not a musician worthy of being paid. It just means we need to give you the tools to show that, you know, get above those thresholds.
Yeah. Essentially, what I'm trying to argue for here is a return to the heyday of music blogging and the hype machine. but that's just showing my age, folks. Now, this is all tied to what we're going to talk about next, which is the raise of subscription prices, which, you know, like going bankrupt, nothing happened for a very long time, and all of a sudden last year everyone put the prices up, and it all happened at once. The DSPs were essentially playing a game of chicken and saying, well, no, you go first and put your price up by a pound or a dollar or whatever and see if everyone likes it. And lo and behold, no one gave a monkey's, really, and it was fine. You know, I'm paying a euro more a month, you are, and we all go, oh, well, you know, we still get unlimited access to all of the music ever made. That sounds like a good deal. You've talked about progressive change now, how the model has stayed and the price, weirdly, has stayed the same from 2008 for 15 years. And now we're in an era of progressive change on the artist payment side. But that sort of implies that we're on the track now for progressive change and upward change in price on the subscription side. So how often will prices go up and by how much?
Oh, crystal ball.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is the first thing, is that it took this long for prices to go up by a pound, dollar, euro. And I think what's coming very clear out of labels is, don't wait so long next time. Warner, Robert Kinkle there, has said that outright, that, you know, we want this to be regular price rises. And I think they're all looking at things like Netflix, which, you know, over the time Netflix has been available, it's regularly put prices up. But I know, I'm trying to think who said it. There was someone who was saying, we don't think it's a yearly cadence. So they're not asking for like a quid extra every year. So no one seems quite sure where the ceiling is, in a way. Because I know that one of the things that stopped people, that stopped DSPs maybe jumping on the idea sooner, was this fear that, okay, we had COVID, we're having cost of living crisis. If we put prices up a quid, how many people will we lose? And like you said, I think the evidence so far has been, you don't lose many people. people are happy to pay a quid more, and it is a good deal. This is the, when you zoom out, it is a good deal. Like paying $10.99 a month for all the music is an incredible deal.
I saw a report the other day. I think this was actually in an article about the very storied journey of Pitchfork.com, about how when Pitchfork launched a very long time ago now, or just before that point in America, the average price of a CD was about $16. And in today's money, that would be $25, $27. And if you were lucky, you bought one CD a month with your pocket money if you were sort of young. It really underlined for me how cheap music streaming is, and that there's, if you shift people back towards paying something they're comfortable with, you could be pushing that number quite high. And I'm sure that's what the major labels have got an eye on.
Well, the big thing that's been talked about for ages is this idea that you cap it when you have, you know, £11. You know, you cap it. People who love music who would pay twice that, you're not giving them away to pay twice that. Mm. Unlike the year of CDs when you could buy it, spend as much as you wanted. It's where all the super fans talk is about.
Yeah.
Super fans who love music and love artists, they would pay more. And how can that happen within streaming services? How can you have a tier that super fans will pay for? Because we seem to have struck out on the, you'll pay extra for high quality music.
Because yeah, then I don't think anybody really wants that, do they? In substantial numbers. I don't care.
Well, I mean, that was the whole theory there, wasn't it? And Amazon was charging more for its HD tier. And then Apple came out and said, actually, we'll put it all in the same price. And that killed that stone dead. You know, everyone else had to say, right, we've got to do high-res music. It has to be the same price as normal music. Mm. But now we're having this talk about super fan tiers and will you pay a few quid extra, you know, for stuff. And there's one debate which is like, more often than you have, put your prices up because of inflation. Put your prices up because prices go up. But then the other thing is actually also parallel to that, how can you offer more stuff to people who want to pay more and charge them more? So I think the basic price will increase more regularly, but it's more about finding the, what's the extra tier that will cost like £5 more that you feel is worth paying for. So there's two things going in at the same time, I think.
So I think as we look into the future, we're going to see the basic monthly subscription tick upwards like every other streaming platform does. And that's just normal and people accept it because they're used to doing that now. But this growing the pie thing where you pay extra for extra services, that's, like you said, it raises the ceiling for people who want to pay it. Now, the issue that sort of leapt out to me there was, okay, what people don't want to pay for is more stuff, more of the app. They don't want to pay for more DSP services. They don't want to pay for high res. They don't care, right? They don't want to pay for, I don't know, you know, they will pay for ad-free, but that what they're paying is to get rid of ads. They're not paying for more of that service. And where that shifts the desire is to, what they want is more of their favorite artist, which, you know, let's say subscribing to the Taylor Swift super fan tier is an extra $5 a month and everyone takes a cut, right? And you can imagine that working very, very nicely. But from a DSP perspective, who, you know, companies that have been very protective and I would argue a little bit aggressive in shifting the power balance from artists and catalog to things that they own, like playlists. You know, if you open the streaming app, you see playlists first, you see their radio stations first, and you have to dig a bit to find albums, right? Which are concepts and IP essentially owned and controlled by artists. So there's a little bit of there's some compromising here, isn't there? Because it's, if they say, oh yeah, we're going to allow superfan $5 a month subscriptions, it's kind of admitting that what people really want is access to the artist and they don't control the artist in any way, do they?
Mm. And that's it. And I think this is where we're storing up a little bit of a problem in a way, or not a problem, a challenge. I mean, and actually, literally today as we're recording this, we wrote about this thread on Twitter by Emily White, former Spotify executive, who'd been researching artist fan clubs for Spotify. And she had these two interesting things to say. One was that revenue from subscriptions can be life-changing, but it exacerbates the hamster wheel of content creation for most artists, because you have to create stuff for your subscribers every month on top of what you're doing already. And if you think what you're doing already, you're serving all the social networks, the free stuff, you're doing stuff with DSPs, you're making music, you're touring, and now suddenly you've got to do an extra layer. And I think we're almost slightly sleepwalking into this going, yeah, superfan tiers, that'd be great. And then thinking, what do fans want? Well, actually, they want, and she said, they want experiences that increase their opportunity to be acknowledged or by or interact with an artist. And they want access. The artist has got to be in there. And it's in this set, like, we're all looking at, there's loads of money to be made here, but what do they want? Superfans want stuff that will mean the more of the artist's time and more of their energy and their creative energy. So
community as well, don't they? I mean,
and
this is something interesting. This is where we get a bit philosophical again, because we've seen, driven by technology in the social media age, real world community is being erased. You know, I saw some data the other day that in the UK, there are only a third as many nightclubs as there were 20 years ago, pre-social media. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. But also we're seeing reports saying that the average teenager meets up with their friends out of home over 50% less than pre-social media days in a recent report. And that has a very, very strong knock-on effect on mental health. And there's lots of issues there, right? So they're seeking some sort of community. One argument could be, why are we seeking to do this online? Go and meet people in the real world. That's a much bigger issue, but probably one that would be very good for everybody. If they want community, I mean, there's tiers here again, isn't there? You could say, well, you know, you pay £5 a month, you can access your Taylor Swift community on Spotify, and you can get a couple of extra goodies from Taylor every month. If you pay 50 a month, and I've interviewed super fans who do pay $50, $60, $70 a month to their favorite artists, then they get the FaceTime. They get calls, they get the hands-on experience, they get to meet and greet. I that seems like it would work fine, but would it actually work in terms of pressure?
It worries me, because the value of a superfan is how much you pay then, not how much you love them. We had a column recently with the manager of Wild Rivers, the Canadian band, and she was saying, yeah, we shouldn't just judge superfans by how much they're willing to pay, because sometimes it's how much do they love you, how much do they share you, how much do they... So that slightly worries me, if it's like you can't get the access to the artist unless you're paying 50 quid a month.
But if a sort of brass tacks question here is that if, you know... This isn't a superfans podcast, but it's the buzzword du jour in the music industry, and people are, you know, the response by the industry, if I can use a very broad brush here, is to say, oh, superfans exist for this artist. We'll put out 5 versions of different colored vinyl, and they'll buy them all. And clearly, the industry response to superfans is, hey, we can milk these people dry and make 5 times the money because they're a superfan. So there is, again, some sort of hard compromise thinking to be done here in terms of the instinctive response of the way the industry works, which is generate as much money as possible from fans, and what it means to be a super fan in an age of community, authenticity, and connectivity.
And at the same time, there are ways, like, I'm excited, and this is getting back to DSPs, that's what, like you say,
please,
like they have that data, so you know, you can now see who your keenest Spotify listeners are in London or in wherever else city you're touring in. You can use that data to then say, right, well, we'd like to do, if you can get access to who they are, you can, this idea of like knowing who the fans are who love you, your music the most, not necessarily spending the most, but who listen, share, and you can do stuff for them. You can do Q&As, you can do meetups, you can do online stuff. So I feel like that's one way where streaming services could do something cool, where it's like, how can they open up the data a little more to artists to help them reward those fans and do stuff. And it's maybe not a case of charging them 3 quid a month. Maybe it's more just like, we're going to help you do this. We're going to help you when you're on tour. You can do a thing in the middle of the day and have your sort of 100, you know, biggest fans come and see you do an acoustic gig, and we'll help you ping them and say, come along. A lot of this week, we've been looking at what James Blake is doing with his Vault, the Vault app he's just sort of announced. And that was all about unreleased music, but it's not actually. It turns out there's going to be the ability to have chats and ping people and community. And I think you're right. I think this idea of building communities, that's maybe the valuable thing that doesn't tax artists as much as having to provide endless exclusive content. So there's lots going on here, but I think the core of this, and again, trying to bring it back to what we're talking about, the report, is I feel like the next stage of streaming services growth, it's going to be about helping people find that value. And I mean that value in terms of fans loving them as well as monetary value.
Yeah. Well, that sort of brings us full circle to the beginning of the conversation and guides us. Well, we're sort of already halfway through the third topic I wanted to talk about, which is the music industry and artists and performers needs, or maybe even demands, from around marketing from DSPs. And we've thrown a few ideas out there, and it seems clear that DSPs, having built themselves up to being the biggest part of the music industry now, with that have the most money sluicing through them, the most users and the most of everything, and everyone's high-fiving each other and high-fiving themselves. What we're actually talking about here repeatedly is needs beyond simple fiscal measurements, needs beyond non-nuanced reward systems, and needs beyond things that can be measured in a quantitative sense. We're talking about community, we're talking about growth, we're talking about outreach, togetherness, and essentially well-being of an artist that reflects then on that all of that together. And that is tied in with giving them tools to do marketing as well, isn't it? So perhaps you could name one or two things that you think would make a fundamental difference from an artist's perspective around marketing in that way.
Mm-hmm. So I think Tidal recently did a thing called The Circle, which is like almost an artist community of network. Mm. You know, so that idea of education, of like, show me how I can thrive, not sink in this environment. And they've all been doing things like that. You know, we work with Amazon on their training courses, you know. That's going to be important to carry on, I think. Maybe it's going to be that data thing, like, please let me do more with the data on the people who love me. Like, don't just show me I have this many listeners.
Yeah.
And there's that line of like, how can streaming services help someone communicate with their most engaged listeners without kind of subjecting those people to endless spam? You know, like
we're talking about control again, aren't we? And what streaming platforms own, which at the moment is the data and the connection to the fan, which artists want. All artists want lots more direct to fan stuff. At the moment, streaming platforms own all of it, and it's hard to connect to them without paying in some way. And even then, it's not direct.
People, like, how many listeners you have on streaming only tells you so much. Like, it may tell you you've been on a playlist that's got loads of listens, and no one knows who you are. Mm. So it is that thing of how do you actively turn people from being someone who heard your track to someone who wants to follow you, who wants to like your stuff. Well, you know, that's where the opening up the data in a way that respects everyone is important, and that's maybe the big thing. You know,
I've mentioned this before, I think, to you on the podcast, and it's something that's stuck in my mind. I interviewed the now outgoing, or soon to be outgoing, Deezer CEO, Geronimo Folgueira, when he'd just taken over at Deezer, which I think was back in the pandemic. And the first thing he said was, why are we not connecting people? Why are we not using the real estate to build communities within our app, our thing that we ask people to pay for? And that was a few years ago now, and we can see that people are making progress towards that, but it's very slow and very cautious, isn't it? Because I wonder if it's, again, this is not cynicism, this is leaning on, you know, 100 years of music industry history, which is, it's about control. You know, it's about controlling access between fans and artists, and because there's always been intermediaries, and this is where we're at. But we're also in a completely new environment where it really makes sense for someone to go out there and be brave, give them all those tools, give them artists access, ease that connection, and help nurture that next generation of artists to grow and fill those top slots in the next 20 years, doesn't it?
One thing that happens is streaming services, we've got this new feature, we'd like you to use it. So Spotify has new clips, short video clips. Mm. We'd love you to post short video clips. Apple has spatial audio. We'd love you to do spatial audio. And they have various ways of prodding people to do that. You know, so Apple case, their change of their royalties model is saying it's going to benefit people who have spatial audio available. In Spotify's case, they have this new discovery fee where short video is key. So, and you'll have artists going, but it's going to cost me money to do spatial audio. It's going to give me, it's going to tax my time to do more short video clips that aren't available anywhere else.
Yeah, across five platforms. Yeah.
And often there's that case of like, we've got a new feature, please use it. That's the marketing lever you can pull. And I think sometimes artists are like, what I want is access to the data on my fans. Mm. That's what's meaning. So I think there is that thing of the demands that DSPs place on artists sometimes, when actually what artists would like is something different. And like you say, it comes back to control and how that loosens up. But I feel like there's stuff going on. Like this stuff is opening up. I think I think, like you said, one of the, going back to where we started, like one of the core things about artist-centric, one of the things Universal in particular has talked about is that artists are really important for streaming services. And that sounds like a really obvious thing to say. Mm-hmm. Of course they are. But like people subscribe to streaming services because they love artists and love the music they make. And so I think reorienting around not just paying more royalties to certain artists, but reorienting about, okay, what do artists really want from us? What would help them build their businesses? And maybe if that could be as strong a signal in how the DSPs decide what to do and what to build as what stuff works for their business model or what stuff copies TikTok or like, I think maybe that idea of being artist-centric isn't just about the money. It's about what you're building and how you're listening to what they want you to do for them, I guess. So I hope that's something that is kind of being heard in the corridors of streaming power.
Well, I'm sure they're all listening intently to your views, Stu. And if you are listening, feel free to email me, joe@musicali.com, to talk more off the record about that. There we go, Stu. Good point to leave it at then. And we've discussed three of the big points, but of course, there's a lot more to be discussed about the state of music streaming at the moment. So please do head over to musicali.com to read the Musicali Quarterly Report on the DSPs, where you can hear about all that and much, much more. Link is in the description below the podcast. Stu, great to have you back. I will negotiate hard with your PA and get you back on the podcast again very soon.
Thank you much. I'm glad that, you know, we get to talk about this stuff at length. It's good. Sometimes this stuff can be short articles and easy headlines, but it's all complicated. You know, it's so nuanced. So I'm glad we got to talk about it for a little bit longer.
Yeah, I'll try and boil all of that down into one tweet to really get to the nubbin of it. thanks, Stu. There we are. Big thank you to Stu, as ever, proving why he's the head of Insight, and I just ask all the questions. If you found that useful, well, first of all, please share the podcast on with someone else who you think will get something out of it. But don't forget, you can explore the quarterly report if you are a Music Ally subscriber. The link is beneath the podcast. And of course, if you're not a subscriber, you can still go to Music Ally and find all the reporting we've done on music streaming in recent times. If you'd like to get in touch with me, I would love to hear from you. You can email me, joe@musically.com. And don't forget, you can sign up for free to The Knowledge, our weekly email, which rounds up all the best bits from across Music Ally's broad range of services. Links to that are also in the description. So that's it. Thank you for listening as ever. I've been Joe Sparrow. You have been you. And until next time, farewell.